Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the silky smooth sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, in Berkeley, California. And Bob is off on assignment this week and will not be joining us. But we are joined by a return guest, Adam Fetterman. Welcome back to the Green and Red podcast, Adam.
Great to be here, Scott. Thanks for having me.
And Adam, the previous show that we did is on one of Adam's beats, which is federal surveillance of climate activists and other political movements. But we're not going to be talking about that. We're going to be talking about the other beat that Adam covers, which is politics, economics, geopolitics around the Arctic Circle. And specifically, we're going to be talking about an item that has been in the news quite a bit, which is Greenland. And so in the first Trump term, Trump had offered to buy Greenland from its colonizer, Denmark. Now that Trump has come back into power, he seems even more fixated on acquiring it through purchase or force or something of that. And one of the things we'll talk about is how actually both Democratic and Republican administrations have cast Greenland as central to U.S. security in the Arctic. And then we're going to be digging into economic and political reasoning behind Trump's desire to take over Greenland. And just a quick background on Adam. Adam is a reporting fellow with Type Investigations, who's written widely on environmental policy, public lands, and corporate and police spying on environmental activists. And you can find Adam's bylines in These Times, Politico, The Washington Post, The Nation. And the articles that you wrote for, that you've written on Greenland, have mostly been in These Times, correct?
That is correct.
Yes. So maybe just to kick off, why don't you actually just talk about some of the significance of Greenland, like some of the geopolitical significance, the rare minerals that they keep talking about, that sort of thing.
Yeah, you make a good point, which is that this is not a new strategic interest for the United States. Greenland has been, in many ways, central to U.S. policy in the Arctic, really since the Second World War, when we essentially occupied the island and then established, I want to say, 17 military bases there, one of which we continue to maintain to this day, the Patufik base, which is where J.D. Vance went last week or whenever that was. So it's never really gone away, but I think what's changed is that the Arctic itself has become much more critical for the world superpowers, the United States, Russia, China, all competing for access to resources, broadly speaking, whether it's shipping lanes, minerals, as you mentioned, of course, oil and gas. And now what we're seeing is a kind of territorial power grab on the part of the Trump administration to try to acquire Greenland in its effort to counter Russian and Chinese influence in the Arctic. So it's accelerating now in a way that it really wasn't under the Biden administration, which was making efforts to improve relations with Greenland and to advance its resource and mining capacities, but it was doing so in a very quiet way through essentially the State Department and USAID, which of course has now been largely dismantled. Yeah.
And actually, because it's often in the news, we see a lot of geopolitical dance between the U.S. and Russia. How has relations between the U.S. and Russia, how have they played into the sort of what's going on in Greenland and actually in the Arctic just at large?
Yeah, it's crucial. I think if you go back to even Russia's invasion of Crimea in 2013, 2014, relations among Arctic nations began to fray. And then, of course, with the war in Ukraine, they completely imploded. And there is an international governing body called the Arctic Council, which is made up of the Arctic nations, of course, and Russia is a major player in the Arctic. And this council is responsible for coordinating research, and it's a forum for diplomats to engage with one another, and it's been quite important. And since the war in Ukraine, that forum has essentially been, I don't want to say disbanded, but there's really very little engagement with Russia. That has certainly, I think, contributed to tensions between the United States and Russia in the Arctic, which I guess a byproduct of that is the increasing significance of Greenland to the United States as a kind of staging ground for potential military expansion. And we saw that to some extent under Biden with improvements to the space base that I mentioned before, but also a lot of talk about potentially building new naval bases, for example, on the eastern coast of Greenland, which is where these strategic shipping lanes are into the North Atlantic. So yeah, I think one of the interesting developments under this administration is the fact that there now is much more, of course, dialogue with Russia. And there have been a couple of stories on initiatives in the Arctic between the United States and Russia to, in fact, cooperate. I don't know where that will ultimately lead, if there's anything to it, but it's certainly something to watch in that space.
Is there a resource competition in the Arctic between the U.S. and Russia and other nations as well?
It's a really good question, because I feel like that narrative is just taken at face value. Russia occupies a huge amount of Arctic territory and coastline, and they have their own resources in that region that they're working to develop, whether it's oil and gas or minerals and shipping lanes. There is some competition for seabed territory, what's known as the extended continental shelf, and the various Arctic nations with Arctic coastline are jockeying for access to that territory. But it's taking place in a kind of UN-mediated framework, and those resources are not going to be developed anytime soon. So there's not a kind of intense competition that is sometimes referred to in the media. And when it comes to minerals, this is where Greenland enters the picture, right? Because when we talk about Greenland, it's often in the context of rare earth metal. And the fact is that there's very little mining taking place in Greenland right now. They do have potential deposits that are significant, but there are a lot of barriers to developing them, being where it is geographically, lack of infrastructure. There are no roads connecting towns to one another in Greenland. There's and population is about 56,000 people, so a tiny labor force. And a narrative coming out of the administration that I think needs to be rebutted is this idea, and Vance repeated this several times on his trip to Greenland, was that Russia and China are interested in developing Greenland's resources. It's really not the case with Russia. And China, though it did have some interest in gaining inroads in Greenland, has been essentially shut out by the United States and Denmark. So the United States, the irony, I think, of what is happening with this administration is that we sort of have the entree and the access to do more or less what we want in Greenland, whether it's expanding our military presence or investing in mining and resource production without needing to talk about acquisition and some sort of a takeover.
And just on that sort of environmental tip, the climate tip, has the melting of the ice sheet contributed to an interest here? So it's easier to access minerals that might have been under like a block of ice, for example. Is this been increasing interest as we see the ice shelf melting?
I think in part of the narrative, it is fueling perhaps this longer term idea that more and more of the island will become accessible. But the fact is that most of Greenland is still covered in ice. I think it's something like 80%. And the only areas that are accessible to mining and development are along the coast. And most of that is the West Coast. The East Coast is even more impenetrable. And so I think this notion that rapidly warming climate is going to open up new mining projects in Greenland is pretty much a fantasy. And the reality is that Greenland's existing resources have not been developed. And there are many reasons why that's the case. And I don't know that the Trump administration is going to necessarily be any more successful in advancing some of these projects than others who have been working in this space for decades have been.
Just as a side question, because you cover Arctic environmental policy, are we seeing that in the other parts of the Arctic, of any of the other Arctic territories?
I think we're seeing it more in the context of shipping, because as the sea ice extent diminishes, these shipping lanes are more accessible and open for longer periods of time throughout the year. And Russia is certainly promoting that and to some extent taking advantage of the fact that these shipping lanes are navigable. But in terms of, I don't really think it's a factor in terms of the kind of development that we're talking about, which is oil and gas and minerals. Perhaps in 30 to 50 years when most of the permafrost is gone. But then who knows if we're going to be interested in oil and gas development in places like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska, which is, of course, the U.S. corner of the Arctic, which Americans sometimes forget.
Just a couple of questions about Greenland. You traveled there in 2023. to research an article. Just a little background on Greenland. It's mostly it's like you said, it's about 56,000 people. It's mostly, they're mostly Inuit, correct? The indigenous population.
Majority Inuit. Yes. I think it's over 80%.
And what would you say is the general feeling about the U.S. and those communities?
It's mixed. I traveled to a village.
J.D. Vance was not welcomed with open arms.
That's correct. Well, I think the mood has changed considerably. And I think it's actually interesting if you look at the trip that Don Jr. took before Trump had even taken office. There was a lot of excitement. It was a publicity stunt, for sure. Came out of nowhere. But I think there was an element of genuine sort of interest in what the Americans perhaps wanted. And there is a affinity for certain aspects of American culture. And I do think that when I traveled to Greenland, I went to a village in the far northwestern corner of the country called Kanak, which is the closest settlement to the U.S. military base. And I would say that it's like a love-hate relationship. There's a long history of, yes, Danish colonialism, but the United States also has had a hand in some of those darker episodes, including the relocation of an entire village to make way for an expansion of the U.S. military base up there. And I talked to people in Kanak who were children when that happened, and they remember it vividly, being forced to leave their homes to settle in this village, which doesn't have as good access to hunting and other resources that they still rely on up there. And as a corollary to that, they feel like they haven't really benefited from U.S. largesse in the region. They get I remember somebody telling me about the fact that they get a monthly shipment of bananas from the U.S. military base, but they were something like $1.50 a piece, too expensive for most people to really buy. And a lot of people up there work at the base, so it's a source of employment, et cetera. And I do think Greenlanders are open and willing to engage with the United States as a business partner, as a trading partner, et cetera. But they do not want to be treated like colonial subjects.
They put a tariff on them this week.
That's been good. I don't know. I haven't looked at those details. Not that I've heard. I don't know if Denmark got hit with anything in particular, but if they haven't, I'm sure that's going to be part of any sort of negotiating process.
Yeah. And what was Project Iceworm, which is connected to the U.S. military presence, I believe?
Yeah, this is another one of the really just shocking U.S. initiatives in Greenland that followed the Second World War. It was a Cold War project to build a nuclear arsenal under the ice, about 150 miles east of the space base. So on the ice sheet, the U.S. Army Corps basically tried to build a small city under the ice. They dug these massive tunnels and they stored missiles, nuclear missiles, and even installed a nuclear reactor down there under the ice before it became clear that the entire structure was not going to survive more than a couple of winters with the change in temperature, et cetera. So it was a boondoggle, and it was this crazy sort of Dr. Strangelovian effort to station missiles that would be close enough to the then Soviet Union to launch a strike. And what happened is that they abandoned it. We abandoned it. The United States abandoned the facility, but left all of the nuclear, not all of the nuclear material, but a lot of the material and toxic substances behind under the ice, assuming that it would just stay there forever, right? But now as the climate is warming and the ice sheet recedes, there is the possibility that the toxic waste will end up eventually in the ocean.
Yeah, I was just having thoughts of Hanford, Washington with Josh Frank's great book, Atomic Days, how it just moves its way into the water supply or what have you.
And that was just one of several sort of mishaps that the United States military embarked on. The other big one that I talk about in that story is the crash of this B-52 bomber in 1968 with four thermonuclear bombs on board that exploded but didn't detonate. And it crashed on the ice. It was the dead of winter and it's completely dark in Greenland at that time. This B-52 bomber, which was basically flying secret missions with nuclear weapons over Greenland, which the people of Greenland didn't even know about, crashes, burns, and who do they call to help them with search and rescue and cleanup? The local Inuit hunters, because they're the only ones who could navigate that incredibly frigid and difficult terrain in the middle of winter and in the dark. So these were the men who were exposed to high levels of radiation without being told what they were doing. And I talked to many of their children in Connaught. And these men, most of them died of cancer years later. Right. And these are the things that the United States, we don't talk about the episode. And the reason why I think they're significant is because you can't understand you can't assume that Greenlanders are open to becoming part of the United States or being closer to the United States without having a sense of the historical context of the U.S. military presence in the region going back to the 1950s. And that is part of the story for sure.
Just go back to Iceworm for a second. Is there any monitoring or active sort of containment of those, you know, that nuclear waste?
There's definitely active monitoring. There's actually a fairly substantial research project devoted just to keeping tabs on how quickly the ice sheet is receding. And there's a team in Copenhagen, I think, that has spearheaded that. And they've done a lot of the papers related to how fast the ice sheet is receding and trying to calculate when this toxic material may emerge. As far as I know, there are no efforts to contain it or clean it up. That's one thing the United States has refused to do, is to clean up its mess in Greenland. We've left behind installations all over the island and have refused to clean them up and had basically left Denmark and Greenland to foot the bill.
I'm sure Trump would be happy to charge us a nice fee to charge them, or maybe us, the taxpayers, a nice fee to clean it up.
I joked a while back on social media that maybe that could be some leverage for Greenland in any kind of negotiations that take place, that the United States finally, you know, clean up the mess that it's left behind from its previous sort of military misadventures in Greenland before embarking on new ones.
I'm going to actually shift the Trump a little bit. And so maybe just to start it off, Trump has talked a lot about taking over Greenland. He's talked about that. He's said it about the Panama Canal. He's talked about making Canada the 51st state. He seems particularly determined on Greenland. And so why are they so determined to take over this territory? And then how does it fit into this sort of, it feels like a late 19th century sort of foreign policy? It seems like the kind of stuff that you saw coming out of like the McKinley era or something like that. John Hay, Open Door, all of that.
Yeah. Of course, McKinley being one of Trump's sort of
heroes.
Yeah. And of course, one of his first executive orders was renaming Denali Mount McKinley.
And bringing tariffs actually or something from the McKinley era too.
Yeah, I do think that Greenland perhaps being perceived as an inherently weak nation is attractive to Trump and the folks around him. They perhaps think that it is the kind of thing that they can get away with. It is a large landmass with a very small population. It doesn't have its own military. But in terms of the larger sort of geopolitical question, the administration is saying that Greenland is essential to sort of world security, ignores the fact that the United States already has access to military, has a large military base on the island, and if it wanted to, could expand its presence, as I've already said. I do think it's a fool's errand to try to figure out what Trump's motivations actually are and whether the folks around him are pursuing the same, you know, quote unquote policy. I do think that J.D. Vance's comments in Greenland did nod to the fact that Greenland's sovereignty would be honored, et cetera. So the notion that we would roll in and try to occupy Greenland, I still think it's pretty far-fetched. But I think what we're more likely to see is the use of other measures to coerce or strong-arm Greenland into the kinds of agreements that perhaps the Trump administration is pursuing, whether it's resource development or military expansion. And of course, the other side of this is Denmark. And the Trump administration, I think, has made its sentiment toward NATO and U.S. support for NATO be clear. And therefore, I don't know that the diplomatic sort of dance between the United States, Greenland, and Denmark has always been a delicate one. And we don't even have our ambassador to Denmark has not been confirmed, Ken Howery, who, it should be noted, was a co-founder of PayPal. He was an ambassador to Sweden.
I was going to ask about him.
During Trump's first term. So anyway, I guess what I'm trying to, I think what I'm trying to say is that, and in the reporting that I've been doing, I don't get the sense that much diplomacy is taking place. So I think what we're seeing is a PR campaign that is largely for the consumption of American viewers. This stuff is being peddled on Fox News. It's being circulated on Truth Social, on X, et cetera. I don't think this is a propaganda campaign for the People Agreement, who have, I think, come to a determination that they don't want, certainly don't want to be part of America. The real diplomacy hasn't begun, and we don't really know yet what kind of negotiation or agreement the United States might reach with either Greenland or Denmark.
It's definitely PR for his base, for the MAGA base, is that we're going to show how strong we are by beating up on a country of 50,000 people.
Yeah.
But they love
that. I think that that's a big part of it. You've got people like Steve Bannon's been pretty into it and seems to have next to zero knowledge or understanding of what's actually happening in the Arctic. There's another guy named Tom Danz, who's the brother of Paul Danz, who was the director of Project 2025, who's been doing a lot. He's a freelance entrepreneur. He was a member of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission during Trump's first term. And he sponsored or helped to sponsor this dog sled race in Greenland that was the initial cornerstone of the visit. Lucia Vance was going to go to this race, basically. But there was a huge amount of blowback, and the people of Greenland were disgusted by the whole thing and said they were going to protest. So then JD intervened and was like, all right, well, I'm going to go too, and we're going to go to the base instead, and we're going to talk to American troops, which Denmark was fine with. And so there are a number of figures who have been appealing to the MAGA base, who are certainly advocating for this more aggressive approach to Greenland.
You could even say J.D. Vance is doing it to appeal to the MAGA base, so he could do really well on a future primary too. So,
What I would say,
guess, you know, I'm not cynical.
The only thing that I would say, though, in response to that, is I really do wonder how it plays in the heartland or in rural America. Do Americans really give a shit about Greenland? Would they want to see American troops occupying the streets of Nuuk? And for that matter, bankrolling the government of Greenland. One of the things we rarely talk about is the fact that Denmark supplies much of the block grant for Greenland to pay for essential services. Now, in the grand scheme of things, it's not that much money, but it, in the context of sort of cuts that Musk and others are making to U.S. government agencies, are Americans really going to want to step up and pay for healthcare and social welfare in a social democratic country? It's hard to imagine. I think you're right on the sort of flexing of muscles that appeals to some extent, but I think it's hard to make the case that Greenland really matters to the average American.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. My other question is around the private. There's in your articles, you actually write quite a bit about private interests pushing for more U.S. involvement in Greenland, and like you said, Ken Howery, who is out of the PayPal mafia, is going to be Trump's ambassador to Denmark. I've also seen some comments from Howard Lutnick, who's the billionaire commerce secretary, also talking this up as well, which could just be because he's sucking up to Trump. But can you talk a little bit about some of the private interests that are interested in Greenland?
Absolutely. I'm actually glad you mentioned Lutnick, because Cantor Fitzgerald, the firm that he was CEO of,
his sons are running now, right?
Is that right? I'm not sure, but I would be surprised. So Cantor Fitzgerald actually has a significant investment in a company that is in the process of acquiring one of these massive rare earth mines in southern Greenland. And it's one of many sort of connections that top officials in the Trump administration have to future mining projects in Greenland. There was a story in a Danish outlet that, based on reporting from a mining conference in Canada, where another company that's developing a rare earth mine in Greenland said that they have investment from Cerberus Capital, and the former CEO of Cerberus is second in command at the Pentagon now, Stephen Feinberg. There's another company called Green Met Capital, whose CEO, Drew Horn, is out there on Fox News regularly, and he's very much pushing this American investment angle. And their chief geologist, this guy, Ned Mamula, has been nominated to serve as U.S. Geological Survey director. And then you've got Ken Howery, who, as you mentioned, is out of the PayPal crowd and close to Peter Thiel. And Silicon Valley does have an interest in Greenland, and I think for other reasons, perhaps, maybe for data centers and that kind of a thing. And of course, and then Elon Musk, Starlink is apparently, this has not been reported as far as I know in the American media, but it was in some of the European papers, is negotiating apparently with Greenland's only telecoms provider to perhaps take over some of its internet service. So there are so many tentacles in there. And I think this is where the real story is. And I think these private economic interests are going to ultimately drive U.S. policy in the region. And Trump, maybe he's shaking things up and shocking the system as a way of allowing these private interests to come in and suck up Greenland's resources. I think that's a plausible sort of outcome of much of this.
It's a classic shock doctrine.
Shock doctrine.
Yeah.
Strategies.
I think so. And of course, creating there really isn't a security threat to Greenland. There just isn't. There is this larger competition in the Arctic, but let's face it, Russia's got its hands full in Ukraine. It's been weakened to some extent. Its navy is not what it once was. China, yes, it has an interest in becoming a world power. So they're building icebreakers and they're doing sort of the soft power stuff that you would expect any superpower to do. But we're not on the cusp of some sort of conflict in the Arctic. We just aren't, even though that's what we're now hearing from this administration. And it's everywhere. J.D. Vance, Carla Sands, who was the ambassador to Denmark during Trump's first term, and a lot of other sort of surrogates are drumming up this sense that like China and Russia are about to seize Greenland. And if we don't act immediately, we're going to be left out and vulnerable in the Arctic, et cetera. It's a real campaign that they're waging. And I think we're going to see a lot of behind the scenes negotiating and arm twisting in the next few months.
Yeah. And how do you think the Danes are going to respond to this? Denmark's a small little country. They're part of the EU, but how have they been responding? And how do you think they'll respond as the pressure builds?
I think they've tried to be diplomatic. They've been careful trying not to say something that's going to piss Trump off. In 2019, when Trump first floated the idea of buying Greenland, the prime minister, who is still prime minister now, Mette Frederiksen, said it was absurd, and he canceled a visit to Denmark after that, and there was a diplomatic row. But no one really took the idea of the U.S. acquiring Greenland seriously then, and now it's taken on a much different sort of tenor. So I think they're trying to walk this fine line. They're trying to strengthen their relationship with the government of Greenland and invest more in Arctic security and in sort of soft power business type programs in Greenland. They have much stronger, there's the colonial relationship, which can't be ignored, but there's also a lot more cross-cultural engagement and interaction between the two countries, which I guess can cut both ways. But I would say that Greenland had parliamentary elections on March 11th. Party that won is, in terms of its push for independence, is much more moderate. The one party that was pushing for independence now, which is what the Trump folks who want to see a major change, I think we're advocating for, that party is basically withdrawn from the coalition. So they're on the margins, and you've got a government that's much more amenable to working with Denmark. I think it's going to be a very difficult negotiation for Ken Howery, quite frankly. He's done it before. He's been ambassador to Sweden. He seems to have a diplomatic circle, seems to have a good reputation, et cetera. But that will only go so far when Donald Trump is talking about taking over Greenland, which is deeply unpopular in Denmark, for obvious reasons, and in Greenland. It's not necessarily a good position to be negotiating from.
I guess my last question is, like, circling back around to something that we talked about in the beginning, is that the push for U.S. somehow seizing Greenland was really appeared on the sort of media radar or the more popular radar, like with Trump's first administration. But how, and we've talked about the military bases and things like that going way back to the Cold War, at least. But how long have in more recent history have we seen U.S. administrations being really interested in having more access to Greenland? Does it go back to Obama? Does it go back to Bush?
Yeah, that's, I would say that sort of post-collapse of the Soviet Union, the strategic interest of the Arctic and Greenland certainly waned. And that's when you saw the United States pull back in investment. And there was a period, 2010s perhaps, when China was making some inroads and beginning to invest in projects in Greenland and then expressed an interest in bidding on a contract for a new airport, et cetera, which is, and in 2018, China declared itself a near Arctic state, et cetera. And I think in the Pentagon and in sort of policy planning circles in the Republican and Democratic administrations, the Arctic was taking on greater significance. We only reopened our consulate in Nuuk in Greenland in 2020, which is, of course, was not a result of Trump's talk of buying it, but it dovetailed with that. And the Biden administration was one of Secretary Blinken's first overseas trips was actually to Denmark and Greenland. So it's been moving up in terms of its profile, but certainly not in any way what we're seeing right now. And I guess Truman was, I think, the last American president who actually expressed an interest in buying Greenland in 1950.
Right, I saw that.
Yeah. So we're definitely in a new phase of Arctic geopolitics. I think there's no question. And Greenland is at the center of that at the moment.
I'm going to wrap it there. Folks, we've been talking with Adam Fetterman, who's a reporting fellow with Type Investigations and is a journalist, bylines in these times, Politico, The Nation, Washington Post. And the two articles that you've written about Greenland thus far have been in these times. The most recent one was back in January, right before the inauguration, I believe. And your website is adamfetterman.com?
Yes.
Yeah. So folks should check out Adam there and check out Adam's stuff. And Adam is a longtime friend, and we've had a lot of conversations about Adam's other beat, which we'll probably have future shows on because that's one of our favorite topics to talk about. But Adam, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Scott, for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
And folks, if you like what you're hearing, please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. If you're listening to this on audio platform, give us a rate and review. And then if you really like, just go to greenredpodcast.org and hit the support button or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. And everybody stay safe, and we'll talk to you again soon. Misbehave, make trouble, all that good stuff. Talk to you later.
In 1846 of March, the 80th day, we hoisted colors, top of the mast, for Greenland sailed away. The lookout in the cross-street stood with spyglass in his hand. There's a whale, oh whale, Fisher cried, and she blows at every span.
I bring away your garden, as well as their own boy.